You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm here today with A.S. Byatt, the author of Possession, which achieved considerable fame in America, and also recently a book of essays called Passions of the Mind, published by Turtle Bay. I'm very happy to have you here because I want to talk about something dear to my heart, which is the question of aesthetic design. And in these essays, this is clearly dear to your heart as well. What is the inner structure of a book? Many people don't know it has one.
You can feel immediately if it goes wrong. It's like the inner structure of a painting. It's the sort of tension between the elements that go to make up the book. And if the book is a novel, the elements are quite different kinds of things. They're things like the characters of the characters, and they're things like the relationship between the ideas in the book. You might have an idea about sexuality, for instance, and you might have a completely different idea about metaphors out of plants. And then also the inner structure is the flow of the whole language of the book from A to Z, from the first page to the last page. It's like a river, but it's got endless little eddies and currents in it which have got to flow inside it. And I remember going to a seminar of Frank Kermode's once, and he said, of course, nobody carries a whole novel in their mind the way you can carry a lyric poem, so they're different to criticise. Well, if you're writing a novel, you do. You actually carry this powerful sense of the shape of it, like a... I always see them in visual structures, you know, kind of geometric designs almost. You carry that shape in your head.
One of the things that interested me most in Passions of the Mind, the book of essays that Turtle Bay published, is your essay on your earlier novel, Still Life, talking about an interest in going from sacred language to secular language, what you call demythologizing images and language. And it seems to be the guiding force behind every aspect of the book, its colors, the names of its characters, even to be what connects it to the previous book, The Virgin in the Garden, which was a book that was full of the high rhetoric of the Renaissance. Now, some people feel that that is, you know, an unintuitive way to work. Is it? I suspect not. Could you speak about that?
No, I think it's an intuitive way to work because it's a relationship of my own life and mind to my culture. And I grew up in a family, that was partly Quaker, which is culturally not very Christian, and otherwise was remarkably agnostic. And all through my life, I kept coming up against Christian language, Christian myths, the Bible, which at first I didn't take seriously. But the more you study literature, and the more you realize how the world you live in came to be shaped, the more I saw, I think, that I live in what I think of as a post-Christian world, though there must be hundreds of people out there who would dispute that. I think... And then I got interested in what happened to the religious sense if you simply don't believe the stories which make up the Christian religion. And The Virgin in the Garden is about sort of the world of the Renaissance in which, it partly is about that anyway, in which this language is alive. It also presents the coronation of the present Queen Elizabeth II, which uses the religious language in a society which I think already doesn't quite know what it means or believe it with the force. And then Still Life takes the characters of the Virgin a bit further, but it changes the metaphor. We no longer have Elizabeth I as the central absent character. We have Vincent van Gogh, who was fighting a huge kind of battle, really, with his father's powerful Christian beliefs. And he kept putting the sun in his painting, and it wasn't God, it was simply the sun, which is the source of life but it's not a myth, it's real. And yet it is a myth.
In American fiction, we have that battle that seems to be ongoing. In fact, in Miss Lonely Hearts, which seems to be in a certain way a religious novel, there is a war between metaphor, which is pulsating and bringing things to life, even though in the fallen world the transubstantiation is frequently horrific, and the dead world, a world of stones that won't come alive no matter what. Nathaniel West describes it as a world of doorknobs and stones that just won't flower, and Miss Lonely Heart stands as a priest between them, stuck on the one hand with dead language and on the other hand with a transubstantiation which has become surrealist and horrific. And this is presented as the modern priesthood.
It's very, very interesting. Partly because I love the doorknobs. I like the doorknobs to be there as the doorknobs. I don't mind a doorknob being a wonderful doorknob. And doorknobs also go into infinity because they're sort of perfectly engineered and they're made out of metals that come out of the earth. And in a sense, I don't want them transubstantiated. I don't, you know, I don't want them to be like the Eucharist in the Christian religion. They can stay for, I mean, going back to Van Gogh, he painted a chair, which I thought was just a chair, and he was loving it for being a chair. And in a sense, you don't have to transfigure it. But then I discovered that he, like Miss Lonely Hearts, was standing in a religious relation to this chair, and he actually bought 12 of them so that he could have 12 apostles of high art in his demythologized house. And I think human beings cannot but confer meanings on objects.
I love the essay on Van Gogh in the book of Essays and Passions of the Mind, precisely because you read with the aid of an initiating critic the Van Gogh paintings as secularizations, humanizations of religious and apostatic moods, which I didn't know the extent to which that was true, but I've found it fascinating to realize that these are, you know, virgins, but peasant virgins rather than the saint.
I knew some of it before I read the critic you were speaking of, who was interestingly a Japanese critic who was very puzzled in an elegant way by Van Gogh's mythologizing of Japan into a kind of paradisal vision. But Van Gogh, I think, wanted to make women stand for women, not for the Virgin Mary. We don't need the Virgin Mary, a mother with a child. And he had this triptych, which he wanted to stand together with the sunflowers on each side of this woman whose hand is rocking an unseen cradle. And he said this is like what church windows were to people in the past. This is my vision. And it was a vision both of transcendence and of perfectly plain things, because the sunflowers are both alive and dying at the same time. He has the seeds and the flowers, and they're the light. And, of course, they're a symbol of the sun, and then your mind starts thinking metaphorically again. I do love... I mean, he's obviously an awful person, but I do love the way he dealt with that particular problem.
These concerns seem very much at the center of your novels, and I wanted to, I guess in a funny way, begin to talk about possession backwards by saying that you've announced, to my satisfaction, by the way, that this is a book that found its audience by accident, that you knew people would like this as you were writing it, and you knew, too, that they might not like your earlier books as a result of reading this one. Can you explain that a little bit, and especially a concept that unfortunately is not very happy, not very present in America, the idea that there are certain books whose presence is more important in itself than whether it finds readers or not?
Well, I think a book has to be read. And some books wait several centuries for their proper readers. And we all know now that we ought not to think of books being written for posterity, partly because we're all constantly being told that posterity will only have computers and screens and films and that the book is a thing of the past. And I don't think I can write as Milton wrote, for fit audience, though few. I mean, Milton's Paradise Lost didn't sell that many, a few hundred at first. But he knew that throughout the centuries there would always be somebody that saw that this was about the nature of things. I knew that Possession would sell, partly because it rushes along in a light way. It has a powerful narrative. It has, although it's about tragic matters, it actually has a comic tone with which people feel comfortable. My earlier books, I had the idea that novels were not about people thinking, that novels are about people's sexual relations, and to a certain extent about their political relations, and to a certain extent about food, curiously. But almost in no novel do people actually spend as much time thinking consciously as they do in life, the people I meet.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the Nicholas Moseley, one of the Booker judges...
I love, by the way, in whose book... Hopeless Creatures? Hopeless Monsters is coming out in America soon, and it's a great, great book.
Well, Nicholas Moseley resigned from the panel of the Booker Prize judges in 1991, because he said the rest of the judges were not interested in novels of ideas. And I tackled him at the party for that particular award, and he said what he meant by novels of ideas was where people thought. And I can only say, I mean, the people in my earlier novels did think, and it mattered to them, as their thought processes changed them, as indeed they do in life. But curiously, that's much harder to read, I think, than books in which the thinking is mostly the author's and the people do the acting and the feeling. I offer you that as an observation, really, of the relation between reader and writer. Readers don't seem to like characters thinking.
It's fascinating because, you know, one of the great joys of Possession is that it returned me to the mood when I first discovered Robert Browning. It was at a time when poetry had not yet opened to me. I thought that people who said that they liked poetry were lying, like people who claimed to like opera. Certain things came late. But Browning, perhaps because he is a novelist poet, really, came early and immediately. Aside from the pleasure of my childhood of having had the Pied Piper of Hamelin, there was There Goes My Heart's Abhorrence,
yes.
What Are Your Damned Flower Pots Do If Hate Killed Men, Brother Lawrence, Good Lord, Would Mine Kill You? I mean, so funny and so bristling with pathology. My Last Duchess or Porphyria's Lover. So when I came to Possession, I was delighted to enter that very articulated world of Robert Browning. Is he at the origin, at the fountainhead of this novel?
Oh, yes, very much. I too grew up on the Pied Piper, and my mother gave me his poems when I was far too young by any conventional standards to be given these works. And so I didn't know they were difficult, so I just read them with intense pleasure, the way you do if you're young enough and nobody's frightened you.
Oh, are they difficult? I thought that they were the easy ones.
I think they're wonderful. I think they're splendid, and I think he's wonderful and splendid. And as far as I can see, he was also a good man. But one of the pleasures of coming to the United States was meeting a lady who came to a reading I gave, and she said, I thought your book was so wonderful, I rushed straight out and bought The Ring and the Book, which is Browning's huge verse novel in 12 books. And so I said, well, it is the great Victorian English novel. And she said, yes, he just happened to have written it in verse, or he would have been the greatest, apart from George Eliot, the greatest English novelist of the 19th century. He had this huge, wonderful, immensely fertile novelist's imagination. He was... It's strange because there's never been a school of Browning critics. He's never attracted good critics
Except, weirdly enough, that he stands, at least according to Hugh Kenner, at the very beginning of Pound's career, that Sordello stands and initiates the cantos, and that they those monologues, taking on historical subjects, making all moments present to now, is the initiation of Pound's modernism. It's funny, you don't often think about Browning in that way, but it is, I think, where it starts for Pound.
I think it is, and indeed possession partly started when I was teaching both Pound and Browning in different courses in London University. And I think again and again of the beginning of the first canto, where Pound talks about Ulysses calling up the spirits of the dead and giving them the blood to drink. And he layers sort of this 17th century translation of a Latin version of Homer into his own verse, which is also Anglo-Saxon. And that was oddly one of the models, along with Browning, for the way I wrote possession in many voices, going back into different periods of history. It's and indeed, the whole of the poetry structure of possession, I wrote an awful lot of poetry in possession, partly came, I said to a friend of mine, the poet D.J. Enright, I might sneak some of Pound's imitations of Browning into this text and pretend they're poems by my poet. And he looked at me and he said, oh no, you won't, he said, you can write your own poetry. And it's perfectly true, I hadn't written any up till then. I went home that night and started writing. And I wrote page after... So it all does tie in to Pound and Browning and Hugh Kenner.
As a fellow bookworm, there's an issue I'd like to address. This program is called Bookworm, and you've said that you are a bookworm. And I have answered the question, as you have, that books interest me more than people. And people take this as an anti-human stance. But I don't really see it that way, and I suspect you don't either. Possession is a book that is a book for book lovers, but people who are not book lovers can be seduced and enchanted by it as well. It seems to me that real bookworms are sort of like that siphon that you put to get the sap from trees.
That's brilliant, yes.
Yes, that bit by bit, through us, drips into the culture the strange things that you find in literature, and that we are, in the same way that a grandmother might tell stories to a grandchild about what the mother was like, we are the maintainers of a great and beautiful and charming and human tradition. It just happens to be that we seem to pull our passion better from the synthesis provided by words.
Words are our most primitive and our most constant mode of communication. And when people accuse me, as you say, they accuse you of liking books better than people, I say, how do you get to know a man better? By sitting and chatting to him over dinner about what the weather was like and if the smog is heavy, or by sitting and reading what he spent 3 years of his life thinking out with his heart's blood, because you do think with your heart's blood and not just with some abstract thing. You think with your brain, which is your flesh and blood, as much as your sexual organs or any other part of you. If you stay shut up with Ezra Pound's cantos, you actually know Pound infinitely better than you would if you'd met him at a party. But people seem unable to believe this. They think books are dry and that real people in the flesh are warm.
Do you think, I do, that writers are different from other people?
They're different in the sense they're rather like monks. They need solitude. They cannot write if they can't be alone. That's one difference. The other is, of course, that everything interests them, because at any moment it might connect to something else and you might start making it into a work of art or an argument or a piece of writing of some kind. And whenever I get really bored, I do something. I mean, going back to our doorknob, I go back to looking at the doorknob and I think, now this is not boring, this is very interesting. What do I know about where brass comes from? Look at the size of this doorknob in relation to the other knobs in this room. And that might not be a writer's thought, it might be a painter's thought, but you can almost always use everything. So you have this double vision of life, as though there's always a mirror as well as the thing, and that the flickering between the image and the thing makes everything very exciting.
Why do you suppose it is, by the way, that these, I think of them as being literary quest novels, whether it's The French Lieutenant's Woman or Possession or the Echo books, they seem to capture the imagination of an audience that would have been otherwise presumed to shy away from so-called literary fiction. Why do you suppose this seems inevitably to catch fire?
I think in the case of all those three books, it's because there's a kind of detective story plot to it, which is one of the very primitive reasons why people read. They read to find out who did it or what happened. And I think if you write an intellectual book in which you decide to run against people's desire to know what happened, people who don't read for intellectual reasons won't read you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you write an intellectual book which feeds narrative curiosity, you can do almost anything else along the way and people will stay with you. You can think, you can paint pictures, you can write complicated metaphors that crop up 300 pages later, and some of them will notice it and some of them won't, and it doesn't matter whether they do or whether they don't. But if you don't have something pulling them along, I think they give up and go home.
I'm talking to A.S. Byatt, the author of Possession and the author as well of Passions of the Mind, a collection of essays. Metaphor does seem to be the guiding force. I love the section in which you discuss James's metaphors as being, I'm thinking in particular of the literalizing of cliches, the cliche of being in the same boat, for instance, and the great way in which you will find metaphors recreating earlier relationships. Late in a James novel, one will see a recurrence almost to an old story of a metaphor that cropped up on page 20.
Mm-hmm.
Or the pleasure also. There's a weird generosity. I remember in What Maisie Knew, there's a sentence in which James says he wondered whether to throw it bang into the fire. And that bang, so unnecessary, is the act of the author clapping his hand in front of the reader's face and saying, wake up.
Absolutely, and it is this kind of making something real that could be an inert metaphor. Another one I absolutely love of James's metaphors is in The Ambassadors, when he says that one of the Bostonian characters comes on in a dress that was scarlet like the scream of someone falling through a skylight. And he gives you, I mean, that's what you can do with the written word, this whole vision in half a sentence of somebody falling through a skylight and blood pouring from them.
Oh, do the fish. My favorite are the fish.
Oh, the wonderful fish. Now, where do they come?
I forget where they're from, but you quote the phrase, fish in a dark pool.
Oh, I know what it is. It's also, it's in The Golden Bow.
Yes.
And there's this brilliant scene in which Colonel and Mrs. Assingham are attempting to communicate and finding it very difficult. And she turns metaphorically, and she's a stupid woman, but she turns their drawing room into a kind of deep underground lake, and she pushes this little boat off, attempting to reach him on the other side. And Henry James gives you this sort of huge, sort of lost piece of water, and she doesn't know whether the prow will strike land on the other side. And it's, again, it's a dead metaphor. I mean, and he has all sorts of different boats all over The Golden Bowl, and says, you know, people suddenly say, we're both in the same boat, which is as dead as you can get with a cliche. But he makes his characters and he makes his readers imagine these two people in their elegant garments sitting in this boat, floating on this dead sea. Or there's a wonderful bit where Mr. Verver is about to propose to Charlotte Stant, whose name I pinched for Possession. And they're sitting in Brighton, looking out at the water. And Mr. Verver thinks he will propose to her, and he thinks to himself that he will burn his boats. And he suddenly sees this huge sort of fleet of boats burning away on the on the horizon in the English Channel. And James does that again and again, and he's playing with language, and he's playing with the fact that the reader is reading alone and is free to imagine anything.
Now, I'm curious. You mentioned throughout Passions of the Mind that some of your impulses both as a scholar and as a writer come in a response to what T.S. Eliot called the dissociation of sensibility, the assumption that once people thought and spoke in images, that in images that were as real and lush to them as actual things, that there was no rift between a word and what it stood for, and this was a kind of paradisal state. I couldn't tell, though, whether you thought it was possible for some novel to heal this rift, or whether it was the job of the novelist to examine the rift.
I don't know if I've resolved that for myself. He has this wonderful phrase about John Donne feeling his thought as immediately as the odor of a rose. And I see my thoughts rather like Matisse paintings in very brilliantly colored patterns. But I think I'm more examining the rift. I think if you look at that process long enough, you can almost write it down so that someone reading your description will know that you were thinking, here is a big patch of purple and there is a balancing patch of yellow and the color sings between them, and that this is in some deep way related to what I am saying about life and death and fear and hope, which are abstract words which to modern people are not on the whole embodied in burning boats or purple patches.
But one feels, for instance, when reading Rilke, that Rilke is a poet who means to heal.
Yes.
Some kind of spiritual divestment, some tearing that has already occurred, and that whether or not a poem can heal it, one will hear in his work both the desperation to heal and what it would feel like if the healing could occur. The language wants to allude to a language of wholeness.
Yes, I love, in the Duino elegies, particularly in the ninth elegy, there's a passage which I met in a kind of pound-like structure. I first met it in a book by John Beer about Coleridge, where he quotes it from Erich Heller talking about Thomas Mann. But what Rilke actually says is, perhaps we are here to say house, bridge, pillar, tree. But then he says, oh, but to say as never the things themselves innerly meant to say. And you can see he's tying language to the things there. The word and the thing are becoming one by the act of speaking them with vision, as in a Rilke-ish way. And I know exactly what Rilke means, but I think you have to have felt that to know what he's talking about. And he does heal it. I mean, temporarily, he can turn his wonderful verbal vision onto things and make you see a doll or a painting by Picasso with a kind of clarity so that you know that this is where you are and that you're seeing properly, as you were meant to see, as he says, as you were meant to see.
Giving you back sight as if you had lost it in some way. I've been talking to A.S. Byatt, the author of Possession, of course, and more recently the collection of essays Passions of the Mind. Thank you very much for being with me.
Well, thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, books, books.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.